Hey everyone, and welcome back. Today we're going to be doing a deep dive that's kind of a head scratcher.
Oh.
It's all about figuring out when the Book of Deuteronomy was written.
Oh.
Yeah. Like, you know how in a detective novel there's always that one clue that's like misdated or something?
Right.
And it like throws the whole case off?
Yeah.
That's kind of what we're dealing with here. We've got a lecture transcript by Old Testament scholar Robert Venoy.
Okay.
So we're going to use that to try to figure out this whole mystery of the date of Deuteronomy.
Cool.
So for centuries, pretty much everyone just kind of assumed that Moses wrote Deuteronomy.
Right.
But then in the 1800s,
yeah,
this scholar named Wilhelm de Wet,
okay,
kind of drops this bombshell.
Oh.
He basically said, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Deuteronomy chapter 12?
This
sounds a lot like something from King Josiah's time.
Really?
Yeah, and not something that Moses would have written.
Wow. So what did he think was going on?
Well, he thought that maybe it was about centralizing worship in Jerusalem for political reasons.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it's like, wow, just one chapter
can
really throw a wrench in the whole traditional timeline.
Right.
It was a pretty radical idea at the time.
Yeah, I bet.
Of course, you know, not everyone agreed with De Wet.
Right.
Some scholars interpret chapter 12 differently.
Uh-huh.
But his theory really started to catch on.
Okay.
Especially when this other guy, Julius Wellhausen, kind of built on De Wet's ideas.
So what did Wellhausen say?
Wellhausen is the one who came up with the documentary hypothesis.
Right, right. The JEDP theory.
Exactly.
The idea that there were like multiple authors for the Pentateuch.
Yeah, and the dating of Deuteronomy was a key part of his whole argument.
Interesting.
He thought that religion evolved over time.
Like?
From like polytheism to monotheism.
Right. And
Deuteronomy, with all its emphasis on just one God and one central sanctuary, fit into this idea of a later stage of religious development.
Oh, I see.
So imagine this.
Okay.
If Deuteronomy was written later than everyone thought.
Yeah. What does that mean for all the books that came after it?
Whoa.
Right. It's like rewriting history as we know it.
That's crazy.
It throws a wrench into the timeline of Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, even the prophets.
Really?
Some scholars even started to think that maybe there was this later editor.
Like redacting stuff?
Yeah, someone they call the Deuteronomistic Historian, or DTRH.
Okay.
And they thought maybe this guy went back and shaped all those later books according to the ideas in Deuteronomy.
Huh, that's a pretty big claim.
It really is.
So are you saying this mysterious historian was, like, editing history to fit their own views?
Kinda. Yeah, it sounds like a conspiracy theory.
A little bit.
But on the other hand, our scholar Robert Venoy.
Yeah.
He sees things a bit differently.
Oh.
He's more traditional.
Okay.
He still thinks Moses wrote Deuteronomy.
So how does he explain all the connections between Deuteronomy and those later books?
Right.
Because there's some obvious links there.
Well, he argues that it's not about someone like tampering with the texts or anything.
It's more about the lasting impact of Moses' teachings.
I see.
So the core principles, like, you know, blessings for following God's laws and consequences for breaking them.
Right.
Those were foundational for how the Israelites viewed their relationship with God.
So those ideas just kind of carried through.
Exactly. So we've got two camps here.
Right.
Those who think Deuteronomy was written later and those who stick with the traditional view.
Like Venoy.
Yeah. So where do we go from here?
Hmm. Well, to try to figure this out, let's move on to the book of Joshua.
Okay.
Which comes right after Deuteronomy.
Right.
What's really interesting is how seamless the transition is.
Oh.
Deuteronomy ends with this really concise account of Moses' death.
Yeah.
He passes the torch and then boom.
Yeah.
Joshua 1.1 picks up right where it left off.
Oh, wow.
With Joshua stepping into the leadership role.
So what's the book of Joshua all about?
It's about Israel claiming their stake in the Promised Land. We see them entering Canaan, conquering the land, and then dividing it up among the tribes.
Wow, so they didn't waste any time.
Nope. And here's the kicker.
What's that?
All three of those themes are foreshadowed right there in Joshua chapter 1.
Really?
Yeah, like right off the bat, you get a sense of where the whole book is headed.
Wow, talk about hitting the ground running.
Right. And there's this constant echo throughout the book. This idea that the land is a gift from God.
Okay.
And they can only succeed with his help.
I see.
You see it all over in verses like Joshua 1.2, 1.3, 1.6, even in the later chapters.
Okay, so before we get too far into Joshua, there's something I've always wondered about him.
What's that?
His name.
Oh, yeah. What about it?
It's such a powerful name.
Yeah.
What's the story behind it?
Oh, you've hit on something really interesting.
Have I?
Yeah. So originally, his name was Hosea.
Okay.
Which means salvation or help.
Uh-huh.
But then in Numbers 13.16, Moses changes his name to Yehoshua.
Oh, okay.
Which means Yahweh is salvation.
Oh, wow. So it's like a shift in focus from human effort to God's power.
Exactly.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Yehoshua.
Uh-huh.
That sounds a lot like...
It does, doesn't it?
Jesus.
You got it.
Wow.
Yehoshua is the Hebrew name that becomes Jesus in Greek.
I'm blown.
Pretty amazing connection.
So we've got this newly renamed leader, Joshua, ready to take on the promised land.
Yeah.
But is there anything outside the Bible that backs up this part of the story?
Hmm. Well, archaeology does offer some clues.
Okay, like what?
Remember those Tel El Amarna letters we talked about in our Exodus deep dives?
Oh, yeah.
They mention these troublemakers in Canaan called the Habiru.
Right.
Some scholars think they could be connected to the Hebrews.
Interesting.
And then there's that inscription on the Merneptah Stela.
Right. What about that?
Well, that Stela mentions Israel being present in Canaan around 1220 BC.
Wow.
Which is the oldest non-biblical reference to Israel that we have.
That's pretty solid evidence.
It is. And on top of that, archaeologists have found layers of destruction in various Canaanite cities.
Really?
That date back to the late 13th century BC.
Wow.
Now, whether those destructions were caused by Joshua's conquest
or
something else is still up for debate.
Of course it is. This is a deep dive after all.
Right.
So let's talk about how different scholars view this whole idea of Israel settling in Canaan.
Okay.
What are the main theories out there?
Well, you've got three main models.
Okay.
The conquest model.
Uh-huh.
The migration / infiltration model.
Okay.
And the peasant revolt model.
All right. So three very different perspectives.
Yeah. Each one offers a different take on how the Israelites came to occupy the land.
Okay. So first up, the conquest model.
Okay. So this one's like a classic military campaign.
All right.
It sticks pretty closely to the biblical account.
Okay.
Israel invades Canaan.
Yeah.
Wins a bunch of battles. And takes over the land.
Sounds straightforward.
Right. Yeah. Some scholars point to those destruction layers we talked about.
Yeah, yeah.
As proof that this is what happened.
But not everyone agrees.
Right. The problem is the archaeological evidence isn't always clear cut.
Oh.
The destruction layers don't always match up perfectly with the cities mentioned in Joshua.
I see.
And some archaeologists think those destructions could have been caused by other things.
Like what?
Like internal conflicts, maybe.
Okay.
Or even natural disasters.
So it's not a slam dunk for the conquest model?
Not exactly.
Okay, what about the migration / infiltration model?
So this model suggests a slower, more peaceful process.
Okay.
Instead of a sudden invasion.
Uh-huh.
It proposes that nomadic Israelites gradually moved into Canaan, mixed with the people who already lived there.
Oh, so they integrated over time.
Exactly.
Interesting.
And this model fits with some archaeological findings.
Like what?
Findings that indicate a gradual increase in Israelite settlements over time.
Okay, so it's got some things going for it.
It does, but it also has some weaknesses.
Such as?
Well, it doesn't really explain all the battles and conquests described in Joshua.
That's true.
If the Israelites were integrating peacefully, why are there so many stories about fighting and taking over cities?
Good point.
Okay. So lastly, we have the peasant revolt model.
Why? Lay on me.
This one's the most radical of the three.
Oh.
It argues that Israel didn't come from outside Canaan at all.
Wow.
They were actually a group of disgruntled Canaanites.
Really?
Maybe lower class folks who revolted against their rulers and formed their own society.
So instead of invaders, they were homegrown rebels.
Exactly. It's a total flip of the script.
That's wild. What kind of evidence did they have for that?
Well, those who like this model point to social and economic trends in late Bronze Age Canaan.
Okay.
That suggests growing unrest and inequality.
I see.
They argue that this unrest could have led to an uprising that resulted in the formation of Israel.
Hmm. That's fascinating.
And even within this model,
there
are different interpretations.
Oh.
Some think the revolt was driven by religious fervor.
Okay.
While others see it as purely a socioeconomic thing.
So even within each model, there's room for debate.
Absolutely.
So no clear winner in the model competition.
Not really. And that's part of what makes this field of study so interesting.
Yeah, I can see that.
It's an invitation to think critically, to wrestle with ambiguity.
Uh-huh.
And to delve deeper into the complexities of the biblical text.
And it's not about finding one right answer.
Nope.
It's more about exploring different possibilities and forming our own conclusions.
Exactly.
I'm starting to see why this debate has been going on for centuries.
It's a lot more complex than it might seem at first glance.
It really is.
And just to show you how much scholarly opinion can change over time.
Yeah.
Let's look at this guy named John Bright.
Okay, who's he?
He was a well-known Old Testament scholar.
Okay.
And he wrote this famous textbook called A History of Ancient Israel, which went through several editions.
Okay.
And what's amazing is how his views on the conquest evolved over time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, at first he was totally on board with the conquest model. He even described it as bloody and brutal.
Wow.
But then by his third edition,
yeah,
he had completely shifted gears.
What happened?
He embraced the peasant revolt model.
Really?
Yeah, he was influenced by George Mendenhall.
Okay.
Who was the guy who came up with the idea.
So even the experts can't always agree.
Nope. And that brings us to another layer of this whole debate.
Which is?
The clash between those who rely heavily on archaeological evidence.
Yeah.
And those who take a more skeptical, postmodern view of history.
Okay, break that down for me.
On one side, you've got archaeologists like William Dever.
Okay.
Who say, show me the physical evidence. Yep. Let's use what we dig up to support the biblical story.
Makes sense.
But then you have the minimalists.
Who are they?
They question everything.
Oh, wow.
They're super skeptical of any historical claims.
Like what kinds of claims?
They even doubt that there was a united kingdom under David and Solomon.
Really? Yeah. So it's like a battle between those who trust the tangible evidence and those who see history as more subjective.
You got it.
Wow.
And it's this tension that makes studying the Old Testament so captivating.
Yeah, I'm starting to see that.
It's not just about dry facts and dates.
Right.
It's about grappling with big questions and different ways of seeing the past.
This is heavy stuff.
It is.
But I'm hooked. I want to hear more.
Well, you're in luck because there's a lot more to unpack.
Okay.
Join us for part two, where we'll dive even deeper into the world of Joshua and the conquest of Canaan. It's going to be a wild ride.
Welcome back, everyone. We're picking up right where we left off with the book of Joshua and the conquest of Canaan. You know, sometimes it's easy to forget that these were real people.
Right.
With real lives and struggles.
Absolutely. They faced challenges, celebrated victories, just like we do today.
Exactly. It's so much more than just names and dates in a book.
It is.
Speaking of challenges, this one thing in the book of Joshua that always kind of trips me up.
Oh, what's that?
It's the whole concept of harem.
Ah, yes, harem. That's one of those things that can be hard to wrap your head around.
Totally. Can you remind me what it means again?
Sure. So the word harem is often translated as devoted to destruction.
Right.
It refers to the practice of completely wiping out certain enemy cities and their inhabitants.
Yeah. That's the part that gets me. It just seems so harsh.
I hear you. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a challenging concept for modern readers. Mm-hmm. But understanding the historical and cultural context is really important here.
Okay, so what was the context?
Well, in ancient Near Eastern warfare,
the
utter destruction of enemies wasn't uncommon.
Really? So it was kind of the norm back then?
It was a different world, for sure. But some scholars argue that harem wasn't just about brutality.
Oh.
They think it also had a deeper theological meaning for the Israelites.
Interesting. So what kind of meaning?
They see it as a symbolic act, separating God's chosen people from the pagan influences of Canaan.
So like a spiritual cleansing kind of.
Exactly. It was about eliminating anything that might tempt them to stray from worshiping Yahweh alone. But it's still a complex issue with ethical implications that scholars continue to debate.
I can see why. It really makes you think about how different cultures and beliefs have shaped history.
It does. And it reminds us that engaging with ancient texts like the Bible requires a willingness to wrestle with difficult questions.
Right, and perspectives that might challenge our modern sensibilities.
Exactly.
You know, that reminds me of something we talked about before.
What's that?
The idea that some people see the God of the Old Testament as a God of violence.
Right.
While the New Testament presents a God of love and mercy.
Yeah, that's a common perception. But it's actually a pretty simplistic way to view the Bible.
How so?
Both testaments reveal a God who is both just and merciful.
Okay.
It's true that the idea of God commanding the Israelites to engage in harem can be difficult to reconcile with our modern understanding of morality. But we have to remember that the Bible isn't just a collection of moral guidelines or a straightforward historical textbook.
Right. It's more than that.
It's a complex tapestry of stories, poetry laws, prophecies, and personal encounters with the divine.
Okay.
All of these elements are woven together to reveal God's character and his plan for humanity.
So how do you suggest we approach those passages that make us uncomfortable or challenge our belief?
Don't shy away from them. Engage with the text honestly and thoughtfully. Ask the hard questions, and don't be afraid to seek out different perspectives and interpretations.
So it's about embracing the challenge.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Sometimes wrestling with those challenges can actually deepen our faith and understanding.
I like that. It's about embracing the journey, even the bumpy parts.
Exactly. And it's helpful to consider the historical and cultural context.
Right. We can't impose our 21st century values onto ancient Israel.
We can't. It's so easy to judge the path by today's standards.
It is. But when we try to understand the cultural norms and beliefs of the time,
yeah,
we can gain a more nuanced and empathetic perspective.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's jump back into the story of Joshua and the conquest of Canaan.
Okay.
In the last episode, we talked about different models for how Israel settled in the land.
Right. The conquest model, the migration / infiltration model, and the peasant revolt model.
Right. Do most scholars agree on which model is most likely?
You know, there's no easy answer. The debate is still very much alive.
Okay.
And each model has its strengths and weaknesses.
It makes sense. So let's go through them one by one.
Okay, sounds good.
Starting with the conquest model.
Okay, so the conquest model's biggest strength is that it aligns most closely with the biblical account.
Okay.
It portrays a decisive and dramatic military campaign led by Joshua.
Right. And there's some archaeological evidence that could support that.
There is, like those destruction layers we talked about.
Right. But you mentioned there are problems with this model, too.
Yeah. The biggest challenge is that the archaeological evidence isn't always a perfect match.
Oh.
For example, the destruction layers don't always line up perfectly with the cities mentioned in Joshua. And some archaeologists think those destructions could have been caused by other things, like internal conflicts or natural disasters.
So it's not a slam dunk.
Nope.
Okay, what about the migration / infiltration model?
This model is attractive to some scholars because it offers a more peaceful explanation.
Okay.
It suggests a gradual process of integration and assimilation rather than a violent takeover.
Right.
This model also aligns with some archaeological findings that indicate a gradual increase in Israelite settlements over time.
Okay, so it's got some things going for it.
It does, but it also has a major weakness.
Which is?
It doesn't really explain all the battles and conquests described in the book of Joshua.
That's true. If they were integrating peacefully, why all the fighting?
Exactly.
Okay, last but not least, the peasant revolt model.
This one has gained traction among scholars who are skeptical of the biblical account's historicity.
Okay.
They argue that the story of the conquest was invented later to justify Israel's possession of the land.
So they're saying it's not a reliable historical account. And what do they think really happens?
They propose that Israel emerged from within Canaanite society, maybe as a result of a social upheaval led by the lower classes.
So they were already there all along.
That's the idea. It really challenges traditional understandings of the biblical narrative.
It does. So what kind of evidence do they use to support this model?
They point to social and economic trends in late Bronze Age Canaan.
Okay.
That suggest growing unrest and inequality.
Uh-huh.
They argue that this unrest could have led to an uprising that resulted in the formation of Israel.
Interesting.
But even within this model, there are different interpretations.
Really? Like what?
Some scholars believe the revolt was driven by religious fervor.
Okay.
While others see it as purely a socioeconomic phenomenon.
So even within each model, there's a lot of debate.
There is. It's like a giant jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
And we're trying to figure out where all the pieces fit.
Some fit neatly and others leave us scratching our heads.
Exactly. And that's part of what makes this field of study so fascinating.
It is.
It's an invitation to think critically, to wrestle with ambiguity, and to delve deeper into the complexities of the biblical text.
And it's not about finding one right answer.
Nope. It's about exploring different possibilities and forming our own conclusions.
I'm starting to see why this debate has been going on for centuries.
It's much more complex than it might seem at first glance.
It really is.
Yeah.
So are there any other points of contention surrounding the book of Joshua?
There are. One of the most intriguing debates revolves around the extent of the Israelite conquest.
Oh, okay. Like how much of Canaan did they actually control?
Exactly. Did they really conquer all of Canaan as described in the book of Joshua? Or was their control more limited?
So what are the different perspectives on this?
You have some scholars, often called maximalists,
okay,
who believe the Israelites conquered and controlled a large territory,
mm-hmm,
pretty much fulfilling the boundaries described in the biblical text.
Okay.
They point to archaeological evidence, like those destruction layers we've discussed, as support for this view.
So they're sticking pretty close to the biblical account.
They are. And then you have the minimalists,
okay,
who argue that the biblical account might be exaggerating the extent of the conquest.
Oh.
They suggest that the Israelites might have only controlled a small area. maybe centered around the hill country of central Canaan.
So it's another case of scholars interpreting the same evidence in different ways.
Exactly. And it highlights the fact that archaeology isn't always a neutral arbiter of truth.
Right.
The way someone interprets archaeological findings can be influenced by their own assumptions and worldview.
That's a good point. It's not just about the physical objects themselves. It's also about how we understand them within a larger historical and cultural context.
You got it. And when it comes to the conquest of Canaan, there are so many factors to consider.
Like what?
Like the limitations of archaeological evidence.
Okay.
Potential biases in ancient texts.
Uh-huh.
And the simple fact that we're trying to reconstruct events from thousands of years ago.
This is really giving me a new appreciation for the work that biblical scholars do.
It's a challenging field, for sure, but also incredibly rewarding.
I can imagine. And despite the debates and disagreements, there's a shared passion for understanding these ancient texts.
There is.
And their enduring relevance for our lives today.
Absolutely.
Well said. We've covered so much ground in this deep dive.
We have.
But I feel like there's still more to explore.
There is. We've only just scratched the surface.
All right. So we're back for the final part of our deep dive into the book of Joshua.
It's been quite a journey, hasn't it?
It really has. We've covered so much ground.
From questioning the date of Deuteronomy to exploring the conquest narrative.
And even wrestling with that whole concept of harem.
It's a lot to take in.
It is. So after all this, what's the main thing you want listeners to remember?
You know, I think the biggest takeaway is that the Bible, especially the Old Testament, isn't always an easy read.
Right.
It's full of stories and events that it'd be tough to understand from our modern perspective.
Yeah, like harem definitely falls into that category.
It does. And it's okay to be challenged by these texts, to ask hard questions and wrestle with the difficult parts.
I think sometimes we shy away from those tough questions.
I know I do. But engaging with those challenges can actually deepen our faith and understanding.
So it's about approaching the Bible with humility and an open mind.
Exactly. Being ready to learn and grow, even when things get uncomfortable.
And recognizing that scholars who debate these issues are actually helping us to understand the text more deeply.
Absolutely. They're not trying to tear down faith or disprove the Bible.
Right. They're driven by a desire for knowledge and a deeper understanding of God's word.
And that desire for knowledge is something we should all cultivate.
For sure, we should always be curious, ask questions, and be open to hearing different points of view.
Exactly. So for those who want to keep exploring.
Yeah, what resources would you recommend?
Well, if you're interested in the whole dating of Deuteronomy debate and the documentary hypothesis.
Yeah.
I highly recommend Treaty of the Great King by Meredith Klein. And for a balanced look at the conquest of Canaan Kingdom of Priests by Eugene Merrill is fantastic.
And for a more critical perspective,
The Tribes of Yahweh by Norman Gottwald is pretty thought-provoking.
Okay, those are some great suggestions. And everyone remember, you can find links to all these resources in the show notes.
Right, and if you want to dive into different perspectives on harem,
yeah,
a quick search online will lead you to tons of articles and discussions.
That's a rabbit hole I might have to go down myself.
It's a fascinating one. But as always, we encourage you to do your own research, read thoughtfully, and come to your own conclusions.
Exactly. It's all about the journey.
And the journey of faith often leads to more questions than answers.
That's true, but that's okay. Embrace the mystery. Engage with the text and let it challenge and transform you. Well, this has been an incredible deep dive.
It has.
Thank you for joining us on this adventure through the book of Joshua.
It's been a pleasure.
Until next time, keep seeking, keep questioning, and keep exploring.